Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight Edition, I'm excited to be joined by Brooke Fault. Brooke is a doctor of nursing practice and an expert in women's sexual and pelvic health, as well as menopause management. She founded the Women's Institute for Sexual Health in 2005 and served as its director at Urology Associates in Nashville for 18 years. A fellow of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health and a certified menopause practitioner through the Menopause Society, she has significantly impacted the field through research, publications, and lectures. Brooke has held numerous positions on influential boards and even lobbied Congress for the FDA approval of ADDI, the first medication for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Her multiple accolades include awards such as the William Oxley Thompson Award and Nashville Business Journal's 40 Under 40. She has been a practicing nurse practitioner since 2003 and remains on faculty with Vanderbilt University. She joined Pizona MD in 2024 as their Director of Women's Health. As Brooke and I wrap up our conversation, we explore female hormone management, addressing misinformation, and emphasizing the essential discussions for ladies to have with their providers during perimenopause and menopause. Let's dive in. So I know we started this conversation talking about myths, and I feel like a myth that you and your practice and at our practice at Brentwood MD, we have to break down is hormone optimization and the safety around hormones and the appropriateness of hormones. So as you think, and I guess we'll target kind of the perimenopausal years of a lady's life, walk me through kind of how you talk to ladies about hormone management during that time. Which ones are most important to look at, to track, to consider optimizing levels for? Just kind of walk me through how you would approach that.
Yeah. Okay. So if I have patients come to me all the time. They're like, I need to check my hormones.
And, yeah.
You know, most patients don't know what that really means.
Yeah.
They just want to check something because
they want to
feel their best, right? Everybody wants their thyroid to be abnormal.
I
want my thyroid to be abnormal too. I want that to be the problem or the answer to all my problems. But really what it comes down to, we don't always have to check levels necessarily. In many cases, we can go based on symptoms or it's an obvious.
Yeah.
You know, if a woman stops menstruating for a year, they're officially menopausal and I don't need blood work to confirm that. If they've had their ovaries out, they are surgically menopausal. I don't need blood work to confirm that. Once we initiate hormone replacement therapy, whatever that may look like, In some cases we do need blood work, in some cases we don't. Like for instance, if I'm using something that's more off-label, like a testosterone we don't have an FDA-approved testosterone for women in the United States, even though we have guidelines and protocols on how and when to use testosterone, I do have to use things off-label, whether it's what I would prescribe for a man and I just dose it appropriately for a woman, or I use compounding. And so in that case, I'm gonna check blood levels to make sure I'm keeping you within a safe realm. Or if I'm just kind of thrown off and I'm not entirely sure what's going on with the patient, they're not responding the way that I would anticipate to a regimen that we put into place, in that case I might throw in some think outside the box blood work, you know.
Yeah.
But we do need to keep in mind that blood work can be very, very pricey, even for patients that have good insurance coverage.
Yeah.
And so not all labs are covered under those plans, and so we want to be mindful of that. But it really, again, I've said this a million times, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse, but it really is individualized on how old the patient is, where they're at in their menstrual cycle, do they have a uterus, when they started menstruating. I even ask about mothers, aunts, sisters, do they know the kind of trajectory of when they went through menopause? Because oftentimes we tend to follow the kind of path that our other women in our family went through. And the average age of menopause is around 51 or in the United States. That doesn't mean that's when symptoms begin, because there's this really fun thing called perimenopause, and it can last, you know, up to 10 years or so. And so lucky women can experience changes as early as, you know, 35 or so. And I'm not saying menopause hits at 35, it's just things change.
Yeah.
And it's not even something you can usually identify with blood work. It's just, you know, acknowledging that, yeah, your menstrual cycles have changed, your emotions have changed, maybe you have some weight gain, your libido is lower, maybe there's good things, maybe you feel better, maybe you look better, maybe your acne is cleared up, or whatever it is that you previously experienced with hormonal changes throughout the month. It could be good, it could be bad, but just acknowledging that and kind of following that through. And when needed, blood work. And when needed, offering up treatment options. Sometimes that involves hormones. Sometimes it's non-hormonal options. But just having that conversation.
Yeah. What are some symptoms that ladies bring to you that your mind thinks, this may be a hormone problem? Maybe we need some blood work to verify or to investigate, and then we may need to consider hormone replacement. What are those common symptoms that make you think that?
Yeah. So let's say a patient comes to me, they still have their uterus and their ovaries. They're maybe intermittently menstruating, but they're kind of in that like 45 to 55 age range. They're not yet officially menopausal, but I think they're pretty close. I might run an FSH level to see. An FSH level is basically a hormone that will, it's not a foolproof level, but if it's significantly above 20, along with some other factors, it can sometimes indicate that, yes, we're easing in that direction towards menopause. And it doesn't usually tend to go back down unless we're like at a mid-cycle peak, but usually that mid-cycle peak doesn't go much above 20, depending upon the lab. I might also, if a patient's really fatigued, low libido, some mood changes, just kind of feeling like apathetic, you know, I'm not really enjoying things or looking forward to things that I used to. I don't like to go out with my friends. I don't like to hang out with my dog. I don't like to, you know, go to the movies like I used to. I might look at a testosterone panel. We tend to think so much about estrogen and progesterone, which are important hormones. But as women, we also have testosterone as well, just like men have estrogen and progesterone. It's just that we have about a tenth of what men have. And so I'll look at those panels and compare it to a normal appropriate female range and see is where the patient falls in that spectrum to see are they a candidate for testosterone replacement. And that doesn't mean that we need to do it, but, you know, is that an option to throw into the bucket of possibilities?
Yeah. How do you approach... I get this question often, and I never have a good answer, and I know it needs to be individualized, but I guess if we look more general for the sake of the podcast, why is it so difficult for ladies to lose weight in that 45 to 55 zone, that classic perimenopause zone? What changes do you feel like are important for ladies to understand, to know about, and how can that be accommodated for?
Yeah. Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah.
Man, you're
Let's
tackling,
buckle up.
You're tackling some tough topics here. Yeah, this is, I think this is super empowering for women to hear, because it makes women feel like they're losing their minds when they start gaining weight, and it seems like it just happens overnight. Our bodies recognize that there's a change happening, right? And our bodies are smart, and they're like, I got you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to hold on to resources. Number one, I'm going to slow your metabolism so that we're not burning through these calories. You know, I got you. And if only we could just be like, no, thank you.
We don't
have that option. So,
so
metabolism slows down about 30%. And we can do all the same stuff that we did. We can eat the same. We can work out the same. We can even pick up the workouts a little bit and cut back on calories. But unless we're shifting, you know, 30%+, we're not going to see that weight shift to kind of correlate with that.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes our metabolism will shift even further to try and compensate for that. In addition, fat cells store hormones. So as our body recognizes we're not producing estrogen like we used to, we tend to kind of pack on extra fat cells in the midsection, like the belly, the hips, the thighs. And when I tell women that, they go, oh my God, yes. You know, they can't put their pants on anymore. They just notice that even if they haven't gained weight, they notice their body shape has changed radically. And they just feel fluffier, you know, that like spare tire or the muffin top that people talk about. That's oftentimes where it comes from. It's our body trying to hold on to as much estrogen. It's like a hoarding situation, you know? And so there's a reason for it, you know, trying to preserve those resources. But, while it's not pathologic necessarily, there's an explanation for it, we understand why it happens, there are ways that we can kind of work around it and kind of tweak it. And sometimes using hormone replacement therapy, it's not obviously a diet tactic, but occasionally what we will see, if we can kind of stabilize things and take the chaos out of the erratic fluctuations, especially during perimenopause is when I tend to see this the most. Occasionally I will see that women say that things become a little bit more settled and they're a little bit, it's a little bit easier to lose weight and get back to their kind of normal body habitus. Not always, but it's a starting point.
That is, what you just shared is mind-blowing to me, because in my entire career, education and practice, I've never had those words to really help comfort ladies. The limit that I've said is, hey, you're not crazy.
That's important too.
I think it is, truly. No pun intended, no joke intended. Because recognizing, like, hey, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. This is a challenge that ladies encounter. But to give kind of that framework of, like, hey, your body's actually trying to help you.
Yeah.
It's just messing it up a little bit. Is really, I think ladies will hear that and really be comforted by that. And then be able to look at, okay, well, how can I assess my metabolism? How can I, you know, make sure that I don't compound maybe this, my body's natural tendencies during these hormonal changes?
Yeah.
So
I'm going to put a little plug out here. I have a dear colleague, Sarah Thomas, that is a fitness coach, and she also does some dietary stuff. She has a program called Burn Fat and Feast. I think I'm saying it right.
Okay. Yeah.
But she's great. She really specializes in kind of the perimenopausal timeframe. So I send a lot of patients to her, and I've had some really good feedback from her program. And not even just her particular program. She happens to be here in the Middle Tennessee area. But I think there are not just us as healthcare providers, but there's people in the kind of health world, whether it's dietitians or, you know, personal trainers and so forth, that are starting to subspecialize in this area of women's healthcare. And so I think that if we partner together, we can best manage these specific issues, because oftentimes we tend to turn to, like, you know, appetite suppressants and things like that. And unfortunately, in this realm, when we're dealing with metabolism shifts, it's not going to do a whole lot. And that's where I think all the injectable GLP-1s have become so popular, because they do work more on the metabolism side of things versus, like, phentermine and things of the, you know, the 80s and the 90s and so forth that used to be so popular.
That's really a good reminder that, you know, you really want to identify the root cause to direct the appropriate treatments and not reach for a treatment that, on the label maybe, you know, something that speaks to someone, but it's not the right solution,
right?
Because it's the wrong problem they're looking to solve, and can't even make things worse.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
As we think about going back to the myth busting of hormone safety, hormone cancer risk, some of the things that truly in my training, or lack thereof, in medical education on hormones, it was really shrouded in, hey, don't touch. You know, it's dangerous. Menopause should happen. Hormones should drop. All should be well. That's a little oversimplified, but kind of the Cliff Notes version. Tell me how you approach the safety of hormones, and ladies who may, through maybe their mother's story or someone around them, have some caution with hormone management.
Yeah. I think that with regard to, oh goodness, you have basically pulled out the biggest possible topics in women's healthcare. And you're
sorry.
Like,
I only had you for
about it right now.
30 or 40 minutes. So.
So let's take this in chunks. The way I kind of start a conversation about hormones and safety is, you know, the Women's Health Initiative that was released in 2002. I call it the gynecologic 9/11. Okay. I remember where I was, what I was wearing at the moment. And even my own mother called me up and she goes, I knew you were trying to kill me with these hormones. You know, I mean, we went from believing that everybody should be on hormones, it's the best thing that you could possibly be on, to nobody should be on hormones. If you even look at them, you're going to die. Right.
Yeah.
And we went in as a country to hardly anybody being on hormones. Everybody threw them in the garbage can. Nobody was prescribing them as healthcare providers.
Yeah, and what year did you say?
2002.
Yeah, and my medical education started in 06, mm-hmm. I guess. And so,
we never rebounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So no wonder nobody told me about it. You know,
exactly.
It was in that taboo time frame.
You were in the time of the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Of the hormone.
I learned about the Women's Health Initiative, yeah. Ironically, but didn't learn about
what we believed
future.
From that point, even as healthcare providers, because at that time, we didn't have all the published data. We as healthcare providers were... kind of at the mercy of what the media was saying, which was basically hormones cause cancer, hormones cause cardiovascular disease, you know, all these really horrible complications.
Yeah.
We don't want to do that to our patients. And so hence, you know, not only that, but we also don't want to get sued and lose our license, you know, and mm-hmm. we don't want to kill our patients. There's just so many different things.
Yep.
So all that to say, it took a few years before some of the publications really came out. We were able to pour through those and go, wait a minute, you know, when we really look at this, at the results and the data and pour through it and analyze it properly, not all hormones are the same. The data is specific for a very specific population. And so the Women's Health Initiative, to kind of, not dumb it down, but make it simplistic, we were looking at much older women that were higher risk. We weren't looking at the common woman going through early menopausal changes, having common side effects of menopause. We were looking at, hey, we already know that hormones have so many benefits. Let's take these high risk, older, complicated women that already have higher risk of all these really awful conditions and put them on high potency oral synthetic hormones and let's see what happens. Well, sure enough, there was a slight uptick in, you know, breast cancer and stroke and heart disease and so forth. And they went, oh my God. And they shut down the studies and just basically said, hormones cause all this stuff. Mm. And that's where that all came from. So very lengthy backstory to answer the beginning part of your question.
It's helpful.
But I try to explain that in a very minimal, you know, explanation to my patients so they understand where all this fear comes from, because mm-hmm. most patients, even healthcare providers, were not aware of this. And then I explain, now taking us to current day, what we do know is that it's more of a timing issue, especially when we're talking about like cardiovascular concerns. Within that first kind of 10-year window of menopause, our bodies, our blood vessels are still fairly elastic and stretchy, and they can accommodate thicker hormone-rich blood. Well, after about 10 years past the point of menopause of no longer having that that estrogen circulating through our bloodstream, if we try to introduce estrogen back into the mix, where we have slightly thicker blood, which estrogen causes that, and then we have blood vessels that no longer stretch like they used to because we've been void of estrogen for such a long period of time, mm-hmm. that thicker blood doesn't quite pump through those inelastic blood vessels the same way that it used to. And so we're more at risk, especially in tiny little blood vessels in the brain and different parts of our body, to have or to be at risk for stroke and other, you know, cardiovascular concerns like heart attack.
Yeah.
And so that's where we believe that comes from. So in general, starting hormones early when appropriate and staying consistent is our best bet at reducing that risk.
Yeah.
Same thing for, you know, Alzheimer's, dementia, that sort of thing. When it comes to gynecologic cancers, estrogen and progesterone don't generally cause cancers to develop. However, if a tumor exists or develops through whatever means, and it happens to grow in response to one or both of those hormones, and a woman is using one of those hormones, it could grow more rapidly. It could almost feed it. And so if I always tell patients, if you were to stay on top of your breast imaging and you find that there's something concerning, we would stop your hormones or reevaluate to determine the next course of action and, you know, deal with it as it comes. But it's, again, it's not so much that we expect hormones to cause these tumors to develop necessarily.
Yeah. Now, that's a great reminder. And I love how you pointed out, I guess speaking specifically of estrogen at the time, you know, early intervention and consistency really helps to prevent a lot of those challenges that were encountered in this study and that can be challenged long ago. Mm-hmm. Kind of makes me think of like a musician, you know, if you keep playing the piano and you play it a little bit every day for a long period of time, you're going to learn more and do better than if you quit as a teenager and pick it back up at 60.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be as sharp, not going to be as fresh. So I love that kind of thought about hormones.
I like that analogy. I might steal that from you.
Well, and I you know, as I think of hormones, I also don't want to, well, I guess just a simple question. I think for ladies, estrogen or estradiol, progesterone, testosterone, it's kind of the big three. Mm-hmm. Are there any kind of underappreciated hormones that you feel like affect perimenopause and postmenopausal ladies that mm-hmm. I may not be thinking of?
Yeah. You know, I used to use DHEA a little bit more often, and I've kind of strayed away from that just because I've seen more tendency for side effects in women, just with my experience. DHEA it's a precursor essentially to some of the other hormones, especially mm-hmm. testosterone. But I tend to see more concerns with like mood changes, irritability, acne, hair growth and things. And so I just find that using straight testosterone tends to work better with less side effects. Thyroid, you know, that's another one I tend to check fairly often. And I'll also throw in a prolactin, especially if patients tell mm-hmm. me that they have, you know, sudden loss of low libido, fatigue, certainly in both men and women, any, you know, like leakage or drainage from the breast or the nipples. That's something that I'll always ask about as well. I've picked up some prolactinomas.
I was going to say, I guess, you know, that's kind of the thought behind that is to identify any, you know, anatomical mass that mm-hmm. could be causing these issues.
Yeah. And usually benign, but, you know, it's the craziest thing to come up with technically a brain tumor from somebody coming in for low libido, you know? Yeah. It's just the wildest thing.
That's a good point.
And it's a very easy, just check a prolactin level. And what else am I... There's a lot of questions. People ask me all the time about, you know, like checking cortisol and things like that. I don't personally find that to be super helpful in my line of work because mm-hmm. cortisol is constantly fluctuating.
Yeah.
And I tell my patients, you know, if I check your cortisol right now, 30 seconds later, it's going to be completely different. 30 seconds later, it's going to be completely different. And let's be honest, the American lifestyle, we are pumping our cortisol to its max. And
we don't need a lab for
adrenal fatigue. But and then I'll also explain to them, like true adrenal fatigue is a life-threatening condition. You know, it's very different from the more alternative concept that mm-hmm. everybody gets diagnosed with right now. And so we have to make sure that patients understand that differentiation so that if they're talking to somebody that's more uber conservative in healthcare versus uber alternative in healthcare, that they're speaking the correct language for their healthcare, you know, needs. So there's not confusion in that. But again, I personally don't incorporate a whole lot of like outside like cortisol testing and stuff. I'm not doing saliva testing and things like that in my practice. I haven't really found any like hardcore solid evidence for it to benefit what I do. Mm-hmm. I think probably 5-10 years we might see more incorporation into traditional medicine of using like various body you know, saliva testing, urine testing, that sort of thing. I find that just some basic blood tests, even that's not always necessary, like I said, but it can be helpful in some cases. But right now, I don't find that it's necessary. The theory, which makes sense, I guess, is that with, you know, saliva testing, for instance, which is the most common non-blood-based testing, is that blood tells you what's circulating in your system. Saliva testing tells you what's being utilized from the tissues. Mm-hmm. So again, we just have like individual labs that are kind of endorsing and selling these tests and then giving you what they say is the normal parameter for the results. And so there's not a lot of consistency across these labs.
Yeah.
And so that's why I don't find it to be helpful beyond what mm-hmm. I already have in my arsenal.
Yeah. That's a great summary. Thank you mm-hmm. for going through those. Last question on hormones. And sorry for getting into such depth on there, but
that's
I was really interested. Postmenopause. Ladies who come with you with symptoms that you identify, okay, hey, this is something that is likely going to be estrogen responsive. We should start you on some estrogen and or mm-hmm. progesterone, whatever the kind of constellation of hormone management is. Mm-hmm. How do you monitor that? How do you balance kind of looking at labs mm-hmm. versus symptomatology and the relief? Kind of walk me through what your goals are mm-hmm. after you initiate hormone management.
Yeah. It's very similar to weight loss. You know, I tell patients fast is not always the goal. You know, I know that you want to feel good immediately, and that would be lovely if I just had this magical wand. But sometimes going from nothing, which if they're well into menopause, you know, a year or 2 years or whatnot, they've dealt with bottom of the barrel hormone levels. And so it might take a few weeks or a couple of months to really get to a good, stable level. And I don't want to crank them too fast because they might have side effects, which could be worse than their original, you know, menopausal symptoms. And so I'll start with a very modest, you know, potency of whatever we decide that they want to do. So whether they want to try a a gel or a patch or in some cases an oral product. It just depends upon their needs and their goals. And patients need to be involved in that decision making, because if I recommend something and they get home and they're like, oh, I can't believe she gave me a patch, I would never want to wear a patch. They're, you know, just like with anything in healthcare, they're going to throw it in the garbage can or just not even pick up the prescription, and they're not going to come back to you. And so, so I just, I always make sure that there's shared decision making with my patient, and we come up with a goal that meets their needs that I feel comfortable with. And we make that game plan, set them loose, and then I make sure I follow up usually anywhere from 6 to 12 weeks, assuming that there's not any other factors associated with their concern. But I tell them, I hope, depending upon what their main symptoms are, if it's like hot flashes and night sweats, within 2 weeks they might notice some symptom improvement. If it's more like weight related stuff, that's usually a little bit longer, like 3 months or so, to see some significant resolution just in the hormonal piece of things.
I love that kind of managing of expectations. And we all, no matter what the issue is, you know, we want things, you know, to come about quickly. We want to make sure that what we're doing is on the right track. So it's nice to manage those expectations and say, hey, we're playing a bit of a long game with certain symptoms, maybe more than others. As we wrap up, a couple of finish up questions, a couple I like to ask. One thing I like to ask is there anything that you're excited about on the horizon in your field? You know, anything on, you know, maybe, you know, well, don't let me limit you, but medications or imaging or what, you know, any therapeutic that you may feel like is on the, in the pipeline that you're excited about.
You know, COVID kind of ruined a lot of, innovation and a lot of reason. I was involved in a couple of clinical trials that just kind of shut down right around that time, as we all experienced. I'm starting to see some things pick back up, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed to see some resurgence of that. I would really like to see some better treatments for pain, you know, in any spectrum, whether it's vulvodynia or pain with sex or pelvic pain or just anything in that spectrum. That would be really nice. I would say I would like to definitely like to see more treatments, not just for HSDD. We have two, which is great, but I'd love to see more. I would love to see the first ever treatment for female orgasmic disorder or arousal disorder, you know, because we don't have anything in that spectrum still. You know, everything is just regarding libido. And there have been a few things that are in, you know, phase one and two clinical trials. So keep your fingers crossed. There's nothing that's like, as far as I know, that's waiting for FDA approval. So, you know, we'll see.
So a distant horizon, possibly.
Exactly. You know, if it was Viagra, it would have been here 7 years ago. But in the female sphere. And then there's a lot of interest in energy-based therapies lately too, I will say. So with regard to like pelvic health, and that's bladder health, bowel health, just overall pelvic integrity. So maintaining not just strength, but releasing tension of the pelvic floor. Because as women, we tend to grind our teeth and we tend to hold tension in the pelvic floor. And that can lead to pain in and of itself. It can also lead to weakness, because if you're constantly tense and spastic in that region, that can lead to an overuse weakness, if that kind of makes sense. And so I'll send a lot of patients to pelvic floor physical therapy, but there are some energy-based therapies that can be helpful as well. Sometimes that work on the muscle, sometimes it work on the tissue for, you know, vulvar skin disorders as well. And so I'm starting to incorporate those more and more into my practice. The tricky thing is those are generally not covered by insurance, unfortunately, and so they can be pricey. I would love to see the price go down on some of these therapies, but the, just the fact that we have these available as alternative options in some cases can be really helpful to expanding our arsenal.
And what do you mean by energy-based? Like laser therapy? Or?
So laser, like a fractional CO2 laser, radio frequency, microneedling, electrical muscle stimulation. What am I forgetting? I guess those are the main things that we tend to use.
That's great. That's great. Well, last thing is just, you know, how can maybe an interested patient who's listening to this podcast, how can they connect with you? You know, what's the easiest way for them to connect with you in your practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, right now I am working in Brentwood at Pizona MD, and I have some social media in which I try to stay relevant as best I can. You know, having kids and being in medicine is a little tricky,
yeah.
But now, so I have an Instagram account and, you know, Facebook, and I try to kind of put some relevant topics out there. I want to get a little bit more involved in that. That's probably the best way to kind of, you know, follow and stay on top. There are a couple of organizations, though, that I like to throw out there for patients as well as colleagues to follow if they're interested in any of these, like, subspecialty areas. All the organizations I'm involved in both cater to healthcare providers and patients, which I think is really awesome. The first one is ISSWSH. It's ISSWSH. It's the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And they have a new, new-ish patient-facing website called Prosayla, Prosayla, I think, Prosayla.
Maybe some AI can help us figure that out.
Thank you. Yeah,
if they get close enough in some AI search engine, it'll pop right up.
Exactly. So prosayla.com. But basically, a bunch of experts have, you know, written various articles on different topics. We publish those so that patients can Google different topics and read those articles. And then there's the Menopause Society, which obviously is a great society for looking up clinical pearls and information on menopause management and so forth. The North National Association of Nurse Practitioners and Women's Health is a good general women's health organization for nurse practitioners, and they oftentimes, once a year at least, will do at least one course on sexuality for nurse practitioners for treating female patients. And then the National Vulvodynia Association, also ISSVD, is for like vulvodynia, vulvar pain, vulvar skin disorders, that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Thanks for sharing those resources. Mm-hmm. Very helpful. And again, Brooke, thank you for your time. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with us. And I feel like this has been a wonderful conversation. And I feel like maybe for both of us and the listening audience, it'll inspire many more conversations in the future, which will be really impactful.
So, I certainly hope so.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.